Okay, so we're going to do more stuff about enolate and enol alpha reactivity from chapter 19. Then I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction about carbohydrate chemistry to prepare you for Dr. Ziegler's guest lecture on Friday, which will be about how Emil Fischer proved what the configuration was of glucose, which is... I mean, you know a lot now, so you can appreciate this. Lots of people can appreciate Shakespeare, but not very many people can appreciate how 120 years ago Emil Fischer figured out what the configuration. Remember that Cooper hypothesized what the constitution of glucose was, that it was a chain of six carbons with OH on every carbon and an aldehyde up at the top. That was a pure hypothesis. It was then proved that it had that constitution. But configuration, what the right and left-handedness of all the carbons are, that looked impossible. But Fischer figured out how to do it, and that's the thing that Dr. Ziegler gets to tell you about on Friday. And you can look at a preview of his lecture on the website. He won't go through all, there are about 60 slides or something in that. He won't go through all of them, but if I give you a little bit of a preview, that might help. Okay, so anyhow, more about enolate reactivity. So alpha alkylation. We talked last time about putting halogen on the alpha carbon, about exchanging hydrogen and deuterium on the alpha carbon, about racemizing at the alpha carbon. But synthetic chemists are always interested in ways to make carbon-carbon bonds. So an enolate has a carbon which has negative character. It's a nucleophile. It's a high HOMO up there. So this is a great opportunity to make a carbon-carbon bond. Okay, so an enolate here is shown from the picture in the textbook attacking methyl iodide. Carbons mostly, remember, are centers of low LUMOs, sigma star in this case. Right, so being able to make a carbon that's a high HOMO allows you to make a carbon-carbon bond. Okay, now it's interesting that it's this resonance structure that does the reacting rather than this resonance structure to make an O carbon bond. And in fact, it can happen both ways. You can have reaction that takes place at the carbon or reaction that takes place at the oxygen. We could think about this in terms of the orbitals that are involved. Here's the enol 8. The oxygen has no hydrogen on it, so this is an anion. And if we look at the HOMO, which is also shown in the book, you see, you're not surprised to see that it's big on carbon and small on oxygen. Right? But if you look at the total charge density, that is where a proton is happy on the surface, it looks like this, right? So the energy of here is minus 143, that's above the carbon, but it's here in the sigma plane that's the best place to be, minus 170, right? So this is the electrostatic potential would favor attack on oxygen, but the HOMO would favor attack on carbon. So it doesn't surprise you too much that sometimes it's one and sometimes in the other, right? So when a positive charge starts approaching and feels the negative charge of this anion, it approaches from here. But once it starts to form the bond, it forms it by interacting with the HOMO, which is mostly here. So depending on when the choice is made, is it early or is it late, you can react one place or the other. So often it's true that protons, that is, if you put a proton in, it'll attack here and make the enol. But if you put a more rapidly, right? But if you're putting it on and taking it off, putting it on, taking it off, putting it on, taking it off, ultimately you'll get the most stable compound, which is a CO double bond, which implies going on here. But if you put on, but if you put on the carbon and you wait a while before you form the bond, then it begins to feel where it's good, really good to begin forming the bond overlapping with the HOMO, and then it tends to go up here. Right? However, this isn't always such a great, in fact, it's rarely such a great reaction, because if you have an unsymmetrical case here, so you have an alpha hydrogen here and two alpha hydrogens here, and you react it with a base which pulls off, puts on, pulls off, puts on, right? You get all these different places that you can put on one or two new methyls. So it's quite a dog's breakfast of products. Right, so that's not so great, but there is a way to get around that in some cases. That's a, not random exactly, but not very good. Okay, but this way you use the strong base LDA to irreversibly pull off a hydrogen. Now this example taken from the book doesn't illustrate it so very well. The reason it doesn't illustrate the selectivity so very well is that there's only one alpha hydrogen. So there's only one possibility. Whereas, in fact, there were three here. One, two, three. Because you can get isomers of this, right? The methyls on the same side or on the opposite side. In this case, there's only one possibility. So when you do the calculation, you get a clean product. But in fact, this is... when you add it to LDA, the LDA grabs the best proton to pull off first, right? So that's selective. And then it's not an equilibrium case because this is such a strong base. So it holds it off and you keep the anion you started with. In this case, as I say, it doesn't demonstrate that it's selective. But in fact, it can be, so that you can get just one product. So it's possible to do these new carbon-carbon bond formations adjacent to the carbonyl group and to do them in a selective way. You can also do it adjacent to carboxylic acids. That's funny because you know when a base reacts with the carboxylic acid, that's the proton that obviously will be taken to make this stable anion. And now it's going to be hard to pull off a proton at the carbon alpha position. I mean, you could call this, if you want, pulling it off from the oxygen alpha position, which is a much better place. But in fact, LDA is a strong enough base that it can make a dianion. Right? And now this one is much more reactive than that more stable anion. So if you react it with bromine, the nucleophile will displace on bromine, Br- will leave, and you get alpha bromination. If you react it with an alkyl iodide, you put the alkyl group on the alpha position. Right? But in order to do it, you had to have a dianion, not just an anion, because the first anion you form is the wrong one. But the flip side of that is attractive, right? That means the more reactive position of these two is the carbon. So it does the trick of putting on bromine or R. And here's a specific example where for some reason, I don't know what it is, they first made the carboxylate using one base hydride to pull off this one, and then they use the strong base LDA to get the second one, and then they reacted it with this alkane attacking that carbon to displace bromide and put on CH2CH2 phenyl. Okay, so that's a 63% yield, they say, of alpha alkylation of a carboxylic acid. Brian?
Can we form the ester too after?
It depends on how much of this you put in, right? As we said up here, this one is more reactive, right? So if you only put enough in, you'll get that. But if you have more, obviously, you can't, you're absolutely right. You can get the ester as well. Okay, alpha alkylation. Now, this is especially valuable, and we've already looked at it, in the case of beta dicarbonyls. So if you have two carbonyls flanking the C, right? This is an active methylene group that we talked about three or four lectures ago. So you can make the anion easily. Notice you make it with not such a very strong base, alkoxide, not like LDA or something like that. Now, you could have imagined using hydroxide rather than alkoxide. But there's a reason not to do that. Because hydroxide could do something else. Anybody see what hydroxide could do? What else could you do besides pulling off an alpha proton to make this carbon nucleophile that you want to use? Kevin? Sure, you could react the carbonyl carbon. Now, if you reacted the carbonyl carbon with alkoxide, RO minus, the same R you had here, it goes on, it comes off. It goes on, the other one goes off, but who cares? It's the same, RO minus. What would happen if you used hydroxide? Kevin, why don't you keep us going? So if you had hydroxide here, it would go on. It would come off. It would go on. But sometimes the RO comes off, RO minus. And what's bad about that? What's the product when RO comes off? It's a carboxylic acid, which will of course react with the hydroxide, right? And then you're dead in the water because you have that anion, and it's hard to make the second anion. You need LDA to do that kind of thing. In fact, there's even a worse thing that happens if you make this into a carboxylic acid. Can anybody think what that is? Not ozonolysis. You need ozone to do ozonolysis. Richard? It's under basic conditions, so it's not going to do that, probably. Fischer, the name Fischer associated with esterification means acid, right? So you can make, and you can't make esters, remember, with base, because the acid reacts with the base, gives the anion. Unless you have something like an alkyl halide that Brian just talked about. Okay, but the problem is, if you get... So here they did it, they alkylated it. Then they did it again and they put another alkyl group on. In fact, sometimes it's possible to put one and then a different one. So you can get things here. And here's an example where they put two benzyl groups on. And notice in this case they used the cyano group, an analog of the CO double bond. The CN triple bond to make the active methylene. Okay, but if you have beta dicarbonyl with an acid, you risk decarboxylation. So if you take this thing, remember, if you make this into an acid, this is the worst thing that can happen, right? You do this rearrangement that we talked about before, and it fragments to give the enol, which then in acid isomerizes to the carboxylic acid. So the problem is that you no longer have a dicarbonyl compound once you make the acid. It loses CO2. Okay, but so that would have been bad in the last slide, which is why you used RO minus rather than hydroxide to pull the proton off, because you didn't want to get an acid and have it lose the CO2. You wanted to make the alpha carbon and an anion, use it to make a carbon-carbon bond, right? While there were still two carbonyls, right? As in malonic acid or acetoacetic acid. This is the ester of malonic acid, two acid groups on the same carbon. One of them doesn't have to be this one could have been a methyl group instead. Right, or an R group, whatever. Right, it could have been a keto acid, and still you could have done the same thing, and still you could ultimately have taken off the CO2. So the neat thing about this is you can take, here's malonic ester, diethyl malonate, ethoxide being used. Kevin, why use ethoxide, not hydroxide? I've been talking too fast, I realize. What would happen if you used here hydroxide instead of ethoxide? You want it to deprotonate. That's the idea. Okay, and then put the R group on. But what else can it do besides deprotonating the alpha carbon if you used hydroxide? Where else can you attack this thing? you can attack on the carbonyl group, make the acid, decarboxylate, end of the game. Right? You have to use RO minus, not HO minus, to do this. Okay. But anyhow, we can do this procedure we showed on the previous slide. Put on one R, put on a different R if you want, then do the hydrolysis, get two acids, right? And now you lose one of the acids, as we just showed on the previous slide. So here's a specific example where they put on this R group. Then they converted the, now they use hydroxide, convert the ester into the acid, decarboxylate. Okay, CO2 comes off. And now what alkyl group did, what was R in the case of making this molecule? What was the R group? Shirley, can you help us with that? In this to make this molecule, what was R? This is the molecule. It's everything here. Okay. Now look at that in the product. Here's the same thing in the product, the same R. Notice that R came as Rx. Okay. Now you have the same R, but it's got two new carbons attached to it. Right, so we've attached two carbons to the R we had originally. Okay, so remember the Arndt-Eichstätt reaction that we talked about last time added one carbon to a chain, but this procedure adds two carbons to a chain, CH2 and also the acid carbon.
When it says hydrolysis, does that mean it's like quenching with water?
Hydrolysis just means converting an ester to a carboxylic acid.
Oh, okay.
In fact, there are two ester groups. It converts two esters to two carboxylic acids. Right? But when you have two carboxylic acids on the same carbon, you lose CO2. So you end up with just one. Okay? The reason you had the second one there was in order to make the anion, so that you could have two carbonyls, so it was easy to make the carbon anion in the alpha position to both, to make the new carbon-carbon bond, the CR bond, right? And then you get rid of one of the CO2s that was only there to help out in the first place, to help make the thing, right? Suppose, just to take this a little bit further, we actually haven't simply added two carbons to this. We started with an X, a leaving group, say chloride. Okay, we don't have a chloride now. Suppose we wanted simply to insert two carbons. So we wanted CH2, CH2, chlorine. Right, that would be just adding two carbons, inserting two CH2 groups. So how could you go from here to convert that carboxylic acid to CH2Cl? You've got to go in a couple steps. Okay? Anybody got an idea? What can you make the chloride from? Pardon me? SOCl2 with what? What does SOCl2 react with in order to give RCl? It was R something, yeah. ROH. So if you convert COOH to CH2OH, then you can use your SOCl2 and get it. Okay? Now, can you convert the carboxylic acid to CH2OH? What kind of reagent do you need? Oxidizing reagent? Reducing reagent? Neither. Sharif? You need a reducing reagent. What kind of thing do you want to add to make this CH2? This is not a tough question.
H2.
You need H2, but it has to. Conceivably, you could have H2 gas and some catalyst that would do the trick, right? Take off the carbonyl oxygen and replace it with two H's. That's what you want to do, and then you still have the OH. In principle, you could do that, but I don't think there's a classy reagent for doing it. But we have a reagent that puts hydrogen on where a carbonyl is. Yeah, H minus is what you want to add, the reducing agent. H2 is a reducing agent too, so if you had a catalyst that would do it, fine. But H minus is more accessible. Okay, so you use something like lithium aluminum hydride, or, and we talked a time or two ago about using lithium aluminum hydride to convert a carboxylic acid all the way to the alcohol. Remember the idea of going all the way with, so two hydrides, come on. So treat this with lithium aluminum hydride, treat the resulting alcohol with SOCl2, and then you've done what you wanted, which is to take RX and make it into RCH2CH2X. Okay, so that inserted two carbons. The Arndt Eichstätt adds one carbon to a chain. Okay, now the aldol condensation. This is a reaction that's very, very popular in synthetic organic chemistry because it makes carbon carbon bonds, but it gives useful new functional groups that can allow you to elaborate the compound, the product still further. So the idea is you start with something like aldehyde. In fact, this specific compound here, its simple name is aldol because it's both an aldehyde and an alcohol. And it's made, not too surprisingly, by the aldol condensation, a reaction of formaldehyde, acetaldehyde. Okay, so it can be catalyzed by acid. Okay, so you could easily take me through this and narrate this this slide, but maybe we'll save time since we're trying to get ready for Professor Ziegler to come by my telling you what happens. Okay, hydroxide adds to the carbonyl, no problem there. Okay, that takes a proton from water, regenerating hydroxide. So this is, hydroxide is catalytic. Okay, so then it's reversible. Right, the protonation, deprotonation, so you could have the hydrate as well. Wait a second. They haven't drawn this right. What's wrong? I just copied this from the book this morning. What's missing? Yeah, the H on the top. Okay. Okay, but anyhow, you can also make, instead of doing that, that's one thing you can happen, you can have it pull off the alpha hydrogen and make an enolate. And the enolate can do the adding to the carbonyl. Okay? And now you have this new bond, just analogous to what you had here. Right? This can take the proton from water, and you have the aldol. So it's an equilibrium reaction. Okay. Now you can do it with base. You can also do it with acid, right? How would you start a reaction like this, where you want the carbon-carbon bond, where you want this carbon-carbon bond to form? How would you do it if you were in acid rather than in base? What form is the carbon that's going to be a nucleophile? Sudarshan, do you have an idea? Can't hear very well.
I mean, you'd protonate the carbonyl group to make it better.
Right, you'd protonate the carbonyl, right? Makes it a better electrophile, and then you'd lose a proton here, right? So you have an enol, and enols are carbon nucleophiles, right? And that's what we see on the other slide here. That we make an enol, it could be protonated to go back to the starting aldehyde, but the enol could also use its high HOMO here to attack the carbon here, right? Then also go all the way to the aldol. So you can make the aldol with either acid or base. This is a neat trick. I used to bring in one of these things to show you. This was, it's called the Soxhlet extractor. It was made in the 19th century. It's a really clever device. The idea is, suppose you have something in leaves from some exotic plant and you want to get out the organic stuff that might be a pharmaceutical base, okay? So you extract it with some solvent, find out what's soluble in an organic solvent. The problem is that it's not very soluble, right? So you have to use tons and tons of solvent. You know, you could put the grind up the stuff, put it in a filter paper, pour the solvent on. The solvent would drip through, but you'd need a lot of solvent, right? And then you have to take all that solvent off again. The Soxhlet extractor is a way of doing the same thing using just a small amount of solvent. And the idea is this. You have a fiber, a paper, essentially, cup that you put here. And there's a solid barrier here. Okay? So you have a small amount of solvent here and you warm it. Maybe not with a Bunsen burner. Okay? Depending on what the solvent is. There's a story behind that from organic lab some time back, but I'll tell you another time. I wouldn't use a flame. Okay, so the stuff boils up and goes through this tube and up to the condenser and condenses and it drips. Where does it drip? Drips into the cup that's holding your ground up leaves or whatever they are. Okay, so it's, you could have it just be a filter paper there. Right, it would drip onto the filter paper, drip through, and so on. But the solvent just runs through quickly. It doesn't have time to dissolve the stuff out of the leaves. If it's sitting in this cup, and this tube that goes out of this area goes up first, then it's going to fill it up until it gets to this point. So the solvent's going to be sitting on these leaves for a while it drips in and fills up. But what happens then when it fills up to this point? Can you see? This is what's neat. No moving parts. Mechanical ones. Victor, what happens at this point?
I guess it'll start flowing back down.
Right. Now it will siphon. So it will suck out all of the solvent and empty the cup. Right? And the solvent goes back down in here. And then it distills up again. Fills the cup. So it just goes... And as long as you run it, it just keeps doing that. The same small amount of solvent repeatedly extracts it. So if the stuff isn't very soluble in the solvent you're using, it'll begin to crystallize in the bottom here. Right? Yeah. Yeah, when it gets up here, when it gets past the top, it'll start flowing down. And then it'll be a siphon and suck it all down. You've used a siphon, right? You've never used a siphon? Wow. Okay, you've got pleasures in store for you. Okay, but the neat trick about the aldol is you need either an acid or a base catalyst to make the thing go. So what you do is use an insoluble base that's not soluble in the solvent you're dealing with. And you put it in the cup up here, barium hydroxide, which is insoluble. So when the solvent gets up there, the solvent, in this case being acetaldehyde, the stuff that's supposed to react with acetaldehyde with base catalyst to give aldol, it'll react up here. It's in fact warm still from distilling up. So it reacts and reaches equilibrium. Right? There's a certain amount of aldol, a certain amount of acetaldehyde at equilibrium. Maybe not very much aldol. Right? But it gets sucked back down, and now down here you have the ketone or aldehyde and the aldol product. But the aldol product is a dimer. It's not nearly as volatile. Right? So what distills back up is the monomer and gets converted to a small amount of dimer back down until finally all you have down here is the dimer. Because you can't go back when you're down here. Why can't you go back when you're down there? Why is there no equilibrium down here? Yeah, Derek?
Base.
No base. The base is only in the cup upstairs. So that's a really clever way of doing it, and worth taking a little time, even though it's not strictly on the subject of the chemistry. Yeah.
Well, if we're forming the aldol in the small cup, and if it stays for an extended duration of time, why won't the base also attack that other, the second carbonyl group?
Oh, it can, but it won't lead to a further product, if you'll see when you look at it. Okay, so it's a and the reason it won't lead. So you want to make the enolate here, and then put another one of these groups on this side. I think the reason is just because this is big, so the steric hindrance will make the second one much slower. But there's another reaction you can do with this stuff, which is it's possible to lose water from it, especially with acid. If you protonate here, you can lose water, tertiary cation, right? So you can imagine losing a proton either from here or here or here to complete an elimination of water and generate a double bond. Which one do you want to lose? Here, or here, or here? Yeah, Matt? Why the middle one? Right, two reasons. It's more substituted, and it's conjugated. So it'll come out here, and instead, this notice what an aldol is a beta, here's the alpha position, here's the beta position. It's a beta hydroxy carbonyl compound. So if you're a synthetic chemist and say, oh, if I only had a beta hydroxy carbonyl compound, you think, ah, aldol reaction. Right? Suppose you were thinking, oh, if I only had an alpha bromo carbonyl compound, what do you think of? Right? You have a carbonyl compound, alpha anion bromine, react with bromine. Right, but if you want a beta group, right, then you think aldol, right? So you can get a beta hydroxy carbonyl compound, or you can easily eliminate that to make a double bond there. So an alpha beta unsaturated carbonyl compound, you also make by an aldol, followed up by dehydration, which is easy to do. Okay, and that's the reaction shown here. Okay, so we protonate to make a leaving group, lose the proton here, and make an alpha beta unsaturated aldehyde in this case. Yeah?
You can't use a base just to pull that proton off?
Oh, yeah, you could do that. But it's easier, but it doesn't happen as easily in base as it does in acid. Protonating the water to make it a leaving group is more advantageous than pulling the proton off here and then having hydroxide be the leaving group. So it happens faster in acid than it does in base. I'm going to talk just a little bit now about what's called conjugate addition, which is adding not to a carbonyl group, but to something that's conjugated to the carbonyl group. And I think I'll do it on the board here since, let's see here, put this screen up a bit. Okay, so here's an alpha-beta unsaturated carbonyl compound. Okay. Now, if you react this with cyanide as a nucleophile, where do you have a carbon-carbon double bond, a carbon-oxygen double bond. Which one do we think of being attacked by a nucleophile? Madeline? carbon oxygen is the one that gets attacked by nucleophile, put O minus, right? But the product from this is in 95% yield. It didn't add here. It added here. And now two H's here. So it added HCN to the carbon-carbon double bond, right? So that's notable. Now, if we had reacted the same compound with the Grignard reaction, phenyl magnesium bromide, you get the analogous addition of phenyl to the same carbon. And that's 96% yield. And it turns out that you can even get higher yield in cases. You notice you could easily imagine the phenyl anion, let's call it, attacking here, that is ending up here rather than here. In cases where that does happen, you can make it for other compounds, you can force it to attack here by using copper. Helps conjugate addition. But if you want not to have conjugate addition, in this case you can use phenyl lithium. And then the product is what we might have expected in the beginning. And that's 75% yield. Okay. So you can either get 1,2 addition to the carbonyl or 1,4 addition. Here's 1,2,3,4. So this added one. Why do I say this? This one is, it added cyanide and H in 3,4. Why do I call it 1,4? The reason I call it 1,4 is because of what the intermediate was. Now you can see why it might be good to add to the carbon over here the conjugate addition rather than adding to this carbon. Had we added to this carbon, we would have put a new group on here and it would be O minus. Having added to the carbon out here in the conjugate position, we get an enolate. So we can, if you like the O minus, you can have O minus. And remember, when you protonate faster on oxygen than on carbon. So this then gives 1,4 addition. The enol, which then isomerizes to the compound we actually saw. So I called it 1,4 addition. But probably it's better to call it conjugate addition. So it's interesting that phenyl magnesium bromide, or especially if you use copper catalyst, gives conjugate addition, but phenyl lithium gives 1,2 addition. Okay, and if you use lithium aluminum hydride, then you add hydride and you get 1,2 addition. Where am I here? Whoops, I've got the wrong. I'm illustrating it with a different starting material now. because I have the numbers for it. An interesting thing for you to think about is this is an alpha-beta unsaturated ketone. It can be formed by an aldol reaction and dehydration. What was the starting material? Okay, anyhow, if you add hydride as the nucleophile to add to this alpha-beta unsaturated thing, you get 1,2 addition. So there's the new hydrogen, OH. But if you do it with sodium borohydride, then you get same product, this is 97%, this is 59% though, and 41, the rest of it, the 41%, has lost the double bond as well. But this does not happen. Sodium borohydride is not able to reduce this double bond. Right? It's not a reagent for attacking carbon-carbon double bonds. Those are electrophilic additions. The sodium borohydride, the hydride, is a nucleophile. So that can't be what happens. This must have come via via this. So the first hydride came to this position. That is, to this position here, right? Put in minus charge here, enolate. Stable, just like there, right? So it does a conjugate addition first and makes this, and then borohydride is able to do this to reduce carbonyls. So this, as you can readily appreciate, is lore. Right? Which reagents do 1,4, which one do 1,2 additions, which one do conjugate addition, which ones do normal addition to carbonyl. And we're not going to take the time to go through a zillion examples of this. Okay. Now, I have just a couple minutes left to give you a little bit of an introduction to what Dr. Ziegler is going to talk about. On the PowerPoint, there are a couple other topics, but they're going to go in those last two lectures after I come back. Okay. But for Dr. Ziegler, is talking about carbohydrates. They're called carbohydrates because their analytical formula in the early days was a hydrate of carbon, right? Skip over this stuff that I... Here we go. For example, when N equals 6, this is glucose. It was isolated in 1792, so early days, time of Lavoisier, and was named because the Greek GLEUKOS means sweet wine. Right? So the name glucose came from that, and os then, that way or this way, became the generic ending for the names of this kind of carbohydrate, right? Now, Cooper, as we mentioned earlier, made a lucky guess. that the formula was HOCH2, CHOH, 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 and we got to get up to 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, CHOH, and then CHOH, OH is what he gave for the formula. Right? We have the picture of it last semester. He didn't draw it going around the corner because he had more light on his paper. But this is a gem diol, so it can lose water and make a carbonyl. So glucose could be either a diol or the carbonyl, or one of these other OHs can add to the carbonyl to give a cyclic compound. So this would then be OH, and this O would have been what made the new bond. So you can get a ring. Okay? So there's an equilibrium in solution between the ring, the aldehyde chain, and the diol. But anyhow, Cooper was right. But who figured out that he was right? Okay, I'd hoped to give a little more indication of that. But in fact, Professor Ziegler was willing to talk about how they showed he was right. This is called was done by Heinrich Kiliani. He proved Cooper right, that this is the constitution. But it's a long way from knowing that's the constitution and to knowing what stereochemical isomer you have, because you can have R or S here, R or S here, R or S here, R or S here, and if you have the ring, you can have R or S here as well. So there can be 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 isomers. Which one is it? Right? And this is what Fisher was able to prove long before IR, NMR, X-ray, anything. And Dr. Ziegler on Friday is going to present you the logic of what evidence and what logic Fisher used to show something that was entirely new. And in this was the work that made Fisher invent the Fisher projection that we've talked about. Okay, so he'll be here on Friday. No class on Monday. But I'll be, unless you are so enthralled with Professor Ziegler's lecturing that he comes back by popular demand. That's a possibility if you want to do it. But it is reading period after all. So I'll be back for Wednesday and Friday, and then that's it.